Imagine stepping into a boxing ring. Like, you've spent decades perfecting the mechanics of your craft, right?
Yeah, the pivot of your footwork, the snap of a jab, all of it.
Exactly. The exact kinetic chain you need to deliver a knockout punch. Your whole mental model of this confrontation is built on angles, reach, and physical impact.
Right.
But then your opponent steps through the ropes, and they aren't wearing gloves. They don't even take a stance.
Which is completely disorienting.
It really is. In fact, they seem entirely unconcerned with the physics of a fistfight altogether.
Mm.
Because they're operating on a set of rules so ancient and entirely foreign to everything you know about combat that your perfect jab is suddenly, well, utterly useless.
Because you're trying to solve a mechanical equation of force and speed,
right?
While they are manipulating the environment and your psychology in a way that doesn't even rely on the physical contact you just take for granted,
yeah.
The baseline reality of the confrontation is completely asymmetrical.
It just shatters your framework. And that sensation, that feeling of encountering a system that completely defies our modern understanding of human capability, that is exactly what we are exploring today.
Yes.
So, welcome to The Deep Dive. It is Monday, March 30th, 2026. And our mission today is to analyze a highly unusual, honestly slightly mysterious, source text.
Very mysterious.
Yeah, we're looking at a 2012 textbook published by the Academy of Applied Sciences. The title is super unassuming. It's simply called Neurophysiology.
But opening the cover reveals something far removed from a standard medical curriculum.
Oh, yeah.
You're not going to find chapters on, you know, standard synaptic responses or neuroanatomy here.
Not at all. It is a dense, unapologetic synthesis of lost history, ancient martial arts, and extreme human behavioral limits.
Mm.
Over the next few minutes, we are going to trace the secret lineage of a supposedly primordial science, uncover a mathematical formula for absolute victory, and break down five distinct levels of combat preparation.
And there is a massive paradigm shift waiting for you when we hit that fifth ultimate level.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, let's unpack this. The author begins not with biomechanics or weaponry, right?
No, they start with a foundational law of human psychology.
Right.
It's this uncompromising rule for the mind that dictates literally every physical action that follows. The text just states it flatly. Discipline always beats class.
Discipline always beats class.
Yep.
Let's define class in the context of this specific textbook.
Yeah.
Because we aren't talking about social strata here.
Right? Yeah, not at all. Class in this context refers to an individual's level of technical skill, their pedigree, their specialized preparation. It's the peak of individual capability.
Got it.
And the central argument is that an individual or even a group possessing the highest possible class of preparation will inevitably lose to a more disciplined opponent.
Wow.
And the text leans on historical evidence to prove this causality. It examines the medieval battlefields of Europe, specifically the heavily armored baron squads.
Okay, the knights.
Exactly. These were knights who had been fed the best diets, given the finest armor, and trained in elite individual combat, literally from childhood.
Right. Peak class.
Yet these high-class warriors were routinely slaughtered by peasant armies or local militias.
Because the knight is basically fighting an individual duel in his head,
right?
Yeah. He's relying entirely on his personal skill.
Exactly.
Whereas the militia, I mean, they're individually weak and poorly trained,
right.
But they operate with absolute collective structure. They hold the line. They execute one singular plan.
Right. Skill fractures under pressure without an underlying structure. Discipline provides that structure.
That makes a lot of sense.
The medieval baron relies on his class to save him, but when the chaos of battle overrides his individual skill, he has literally nothing to fall back on. The disciplined unit absorbs the chaos.
And what's interesting is the textbook pulls that exact same mechanism into the modern era,
yeah.
Looking at global sports.
Yes, the football example.
Yeah, take the World Cup. You consistently see these giant, superstar-studded football teams.
Yes.
Teams overflowing with world-class talent and individual pedigree just implode.
Right. They don't even make it past the qualifying round sometimes.
Exactly. Meanwhile, some obscure team without a single famous name on the roster, operating with just a ruthless systematic discipline, advances to the finals. It's like that old saying, hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard, but taken to a structural extreme.
Because the underlying mechanism remains identical whether you are holding a broadsword or kicking a football.
Yeah.
Discipline neutralizes individual brilliance because discipline creates predictability and endurance, whereas pure class often relies on, you know, volatile, momentary inspiration.
That makes intuitive sense. But it also raises a pretty big flag for me. If the ultimate goal of this neurophysiology text is to build an unbeatable practitioner, relying solely on discipline sounds like you are just creating a very obedient, unskilled robot.
Right.
And that can't be the final equation for victory, can it?
It isn't. Discipline beating class is just the baseline reality of conflict. But the ultimate formula, the state of being an absolute victor, requires a synthesis.
Okay.
The textbook argues that victory is the product of multiplying strict discipline by a highly elevated class of knowledge.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. When a practitioner possesses both the rigid internal structure of discipline and the high-level operational skill of class, they become mathematically unbeatable. Defeat is only introduced into the equation when one of those two variables drops to zero.
Which introduces a massive question for anyone reading this. If becoming this absolute victor requires a supreme class of knowledge, where exactly is the knowledge in this specific textbook coming from?
That is the big question.
Because the author doesn't just present this as a good theory. They make staggering claims about its superiority over literally everything else.
The claim is absolute. The text asserts that the foundation of class it teaches cannot be found in any modern university, any contemporary research institute, or even within classified intelligence archives. Nowhere. It justifies this by tracing a hidden, highly specialized lineage.
The secret lineage of Slavic applied science.
Exactly. And it starts with a figure named academician Yakovlev. He was a scientist dedicated to a niche field he termed applied history.
Applied history.
Right. Yakovlev was not cataloging dates or tracking the movement of borders. He was excavating the past for the primordial source code of human behavior.
Wow.
He hypothesized the existence of an original, undistorted global doctrine that predated all known philosophies and martial systems.
So he was basically looking for the root of the tree, assuming everything we have today, from modern psychology to boxing, are just the outer branches.
Precisely. And Yakovlev managed to piece together fragmented remnants of this ancient knowledge. He eventually transmitted these fragments to a man named General Viktor Pavlovich Svetlov.
Okay.
Svetlov was a highly capable, brilliant military professional who actually understood the practical application of these historical mechanics.
And here is where the lineage tightens up into something almost cinematic. General Svetlov takes this fragmented, highly guarded knowledge and becomes a mentor. And his student is a 15-year-old boy named Dr. Oleg Viktorovich Maltsev.
Well, he was 15 at the time. Dr. Maltsev is the author of our textbook.
Right.
The text credits him with achieving what Yakovlev and Svetlov started, taking those disjointed fragments and fully restoring the ancient knowledge to its pure operational form.
Incredible.
The resulting system is what the text calls Slavic applied science. And this is where the timeline presented in the text becomes highly controversial.
Yeah, I'll say.
It claims this restored foundation dates back over 200 million years.
Hold on. 200 million years. I have to throw a flag on the play there. The Triassic period was 200 billion years ago. We are talking about the dawn of dinosaurs here.
I know. It sounds wild.
Mammals barely existed, let alone human beings practicing complex martial arts and neurophysiology. How does the text possibly justify a timeline that completely ignores the established fossil record of human evolution?
Well, it requires looking at the text's framing, which leans heavily into the mythological and the primordial. The author is not claiming that a carbon-dated artifact of a martial arts manual exists from the Triassic period.
Okay.
Rather, the text treats this knowledge as a universal underlying law of physics and human consciousness.
Wow.
In their view, these mechanics have always existed within the architecture of the universe, long before recorded human history, just waiting to be restored or tapped into rather than invented. What's fascinating here is how unapologetically the text elevates this primordial science.
Right. It doesn't hold back.
Not at all. It firmly asserts that because this knowledge is the original uncorrupted truth of human mechanics, it is inherently superior to any modern classical scientific method developed in the last few centuries.
It demands that the reader accept it as the apex.
Mm.
And because it demands that level of absolute supremacy, the author installs a massive firewall early in the book.
Yes, a very strict one.
If you're listening to this and trying to categorize Slavic applied science, maybe wondering if it's similar to Aikido or cognitive behavioral therapy or systematoma, the text expressly forbids you from doing that.
It is the most rigid boundary in the curriculum, the non-comparison rule. A student is strictly prohibited from attempting to compare this science to any other worldly system, martial art, or academic discipline.
But wait, as a learner, as someone who loves learning, I have to push back on that for you guys listening. The primary mechanism of the human brain when encountering novel information is to build mental scaffolding.
Right. Making connections.
We learn by analogy. You connect the unknown to the known. Like, if I'm trying to understand a new software program, I compare its interface to the one I already use. Why does this text actively outlaw the fundamental biological process of learning?
To understand that, we have to examine the author's view of those known things you're trying to connect to. The text explicitly calls out other renowned Russian martial systems, Kadochnikov, Lavrov, Solovyov, Vasilyev, Ryabko, and lumps them in with the entirety of modern classical science.
Wow.
It labels all of them as distorted fragments. They are corrupted echoes of the original doctrine.
So if you try to map perfection onto imperfection, you just lose the perfection.
Exactly. You are essentially pouring highly purified water into a contaminated glass. The text argues that your existing mental frameworks are flawed.
Right.
If you try to adapt this high-precision primordial science to fit into your current understanding of psychology or combat, you degrade the science to your current level of preparation. You ruin the results.
You ruin it.
Yeah. The strictness of the non-comparison rule is designed to force the student to completely abandon their previous assumptions.
You literally have to empty your cup completely. And honestly, the rigidity makes a lot more sense when you realize who originally wielded this system?
Yeah.
We aren't talking about battlefield mercenaries or street fighters.
No.
The text reveals that this system has deep ancient priestly roots.
The custodians of this knowledge were the ancient clergy. And these individuals operated as a unique hybrid, right? They were spiritual mentors, absolute moral authorities, and elite, uncompromising warriors.
It's a heavy combination.
It is. Long before politicians or public figures managed society, these warrior priests were responsible for the survival and direction of the Slavic peoples.
And understanding that priestly mandate, the responsibility to manage society and resolve complex life or death problems, it completely shifts how we should look at their physical training.
Absolutely.
Because the textbook outlines five levels of combat preparation. But these aren't like belts in a dojo. They're distinct spatial and situational frameworks designed to prepare a person for any chaotic scenario life throws at them.
Yes.
Let's walk through the physical progression, starting with level one. Wrestling.
So wrestling is the foundation, and it's taught from early childhood. The mechanical focus here is not striking. It is the manipulation of the center of gravity. It prepares the practitioner for the most claustrophobic scenario possible. Two combatants have closed distance entirely and are locked together.
You have zero space.
Zero.
You have to understand leverage, weight distribution, and how to unbalance a kinetic force that is directly on top of you. And once you understand how to manage a body in close quarters, the training moves to level two, which is termed Okhotsk combat or hunting combat.
Right. And the situational parameters for hunting combat are highly specific and designed for a sudden disadvantage.
Right.
Imagine you are on a battlefield, but your primary offensive weapon, your sword, has been disarmed or lost. You are left holding a shield on your left arm with an empty right hand.
Your instinct in that scenario would just be panic. You'd think the goal would be desperate, lethal strikes with whatever you have left.
Mm.
But the text reveals a very different, highly controlled philosophy.
It does.
The objective of hunting combat is not to cause deep wounds or to kill the opponent.
Because the mindset is that of a hunter trapping game, not a butcher. The mechanical goal is absolute control. You use the shield defensively to absorb and redirect the opponent's kinetic energy, while the empty hand is used to manipulate joints, the neck, or the weapon arm.
You're trapping them.
Exactly. You are constantly breaking their equilibrium, neutralizing their aggression without necessarily destroying them. It requires a massive amount of restraint and spatial awareness.
So you're neutralizing the threat by making it physically impossible for them to continue attacking.
Yes.
Now, if you maintain possession of your weapon, you enter the parameters of level three, fist combat. In this scenario, you are fully armed with both sword and shield. And there's a biomechanical detail here that is just fascinating to me. The text explicitly states that this level of the system does not feature traditional leg strikes. There are no high kicks or roundhouses.
None. And the absence of kicks is entirely rooted in physics and structure. When you are wielding a heavy sword and absorbing impacts on a shield, your physical base must be completely rooted to the ground. Launching a high kick compromises your center of gravity, making you easily toppled by a counterforce.
A single push to your chest while you're standing on one leg and you're on your back in a battlefield, which is a death sentence.
Precisely. The legs are still utilized, but as structural tools.
Okay.
They're used to manipulate the opponent's base, sweeping an ankle to topple them, stepping to block their forward momentum, or trapping a dropped weapon. The sword and shield provide the primary offense and defense, while the legs ensure you remain an immovable object.
Which brings us to the ultimate physical compilation of these skills, level 4. Nobility Setch. This is the scenario of absolute overwhelming chaos.
You are no longer fighting a duel, you are managing a crowd.
Right.
Nobility Setch prepares the warrior to face superior multiple forces. The attackers might rush you chaotically, attempt to surround you in a circle, or attack in disciplined columns.
And the weaponry changes here, too. The text describes wielding dual axes, two swords, or a highly specific specialized weapon called the Gelba.
The Gelba. It's a large priestly knife, and its dimensions are non-negotiable. It is exactly one elbow in length.
Very specific.
Very. And Nobility Setch relies on extreme geometric positioning. You are using the Gelba or dual swords not just to strike, but to create funnels and manage distance.
Okay.
It is the synthesis of everything learned from childhood, unbalancing from wrestling, trapping from hunting combat, and the rooted base of fist combat applied rapidly against a swarm of attackers.
Wow.
You must defeat the first, instantly pivot to the second, and neutralize the third, all while maintaining perfect spatial control.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because if you look at those four levels, wrestling, hunting combat, fist combat, and nobility setch, you see a highly sophisticated, complete physical system for surviving violence.
Absolutely.
Most martial arts manuals would just end there. But this text introduces a fifth level, and level 5 entirely abandons the physical realm.
Level 5 is non-contact work.
It is the ability to solve the task, to completely defeat or neutralize the opponent without ever physically touching them.
And it is here that the textbook forces a complete reversal of how we view human history.
Yeah.
Because the modern assumption about the evolution of conflict is linear, right? Early humans wrestled and hit each other with rocks. As we evolved and our brains developed, combat became more sophisticated, eventually leading to mystical, philosophical, non-contact concepts as a sort of intellectual add-on.
Right. We view non-contact as the ultimate evolution, like the highest peak you might reach after a lifetime of physical brawling. But the text argues the exact opposite is true.
The author asserts that in the primordial first period of human history, all martial art was non-contact.
All of it.
All of it. Resolving conflict without physical touch was the original default state of humanity.
So if our ancestors possessed the ability to resolve life or death conflicts without crossing the physical distance, what happened? Why did we devolve into swinging swords and shooting each other?
The textbook frames human history as a tragic regression. As conflicts escalated and the desire for power grew, enemies realized they could not defeat a master of non-contact work head-on. The only tactical solution was assassination.
Wow.
They began systematically killing fighters before they could fully learn the art, and more importantly, they targeted and murdered the masters who held the knowledge.
They severed the lineage. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you kill the teacher, the knowledge dies in that generation.
The chain of succession was broken. As humanity lost these spiritual inherent capacities for non-contact work, we were forced to degrade our methods. We dropped down to level 4, picking up the Gelba and the sword out of sheer necessity to survive mass physical attacks. We devolved from internal mastery to external violence.
It is a profound shift in perspective.
Okay.
Physical combat isn't an achievement of human evolution. It is a symptom of our lost history.
Oh, sex.
So if a practitioner reading this in 2012 or you listening today in 2026 wants to reclaim that lost history and learn the fifth level, what is the mechanism? How do you actually train for non-contact?
Well, the text establishes a seemingly insurmountable prerequisite. You cannot simply walk into a seminar and learn the physical mechanics of non-contact work.
Why?
The author states that a person can only access this level when they have achieved a highly elevated state of spiritual awareness. They must possess a deep, uncompromising internal necessity for justice and correct living.
You cannot separate the physics from the morality if you lack the spiritual weight. The mechanical reality of non-contact remains completely inaccessible to you.
It acts as an organic security clearance. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the textbook uses this concept of lost abilities to offer a devastating critique of modern life.
Yeah, this part really hit me.
It argues that instead of doing the incredibly difficult internal work required to train our inherent human abilities, like non-contact, spatial awareness, or even just raw discipline, humanity has chosen the path of least resistance.
We really have.
We rely almost entirely on what the author terms prosthetics.
Prosthetics.
Yes. In the context of this science, a prosthetic is any external tool we invent to solve a problem that we originally had the internal capacity to solve ourselves.
Like what?
A firearm is a prosthetic for lost combat ability. A calculator is a prosthetic for mental computation. Advanced technology, while convenient, is fundamentally a prosthetic.
Wow.
The text argues that by constantly trading the cultivation of our internal human spirit for the convenience of external tools, the human being continues to atrophy and degrade.
We let the tool carry the weight, and our own muscles basically wither away. So what does this all mean for you? We have excavated a truly dense, uncompromising piece of source material today.
We examine the mathematical reality that discipline, when acting as a multiplier for a high class of knowledge, creates an absolute victor.
We challenge the ancient primordial origins of Slavic applied science, exploring why the text demands a complete abandonment of your existing mental models through the non-comparison rule.
And we tracked the tragedy of human combat, realizing that moving from wrestling up through hunting and fist combat to nobility such is actually a documentation of how far we have fallen from the original spiritually elevated reality of non-contact work.
It reframes every physical conflict as a reminder of what we have forgotten. Before we wrap up, I want to pass it over to my co-host for one final thought to leave you with today.
Let's focus on that final piercing concept of prosthetics. The textbook forces us to view modern weapons and conveniences not as progress, but as crutches covering up our degraded human potential.
Yeah.
Take a hard look at your own daily routine, your career, the way you navigate the world. How many modern prosthetics, whether it is an AI application you use to draft your emails, a GPS you rely on to navigate your own city, or even a digital distraction you use to avoid sitting with difficult thoughts, are you leaning on right now?
That's a great point.
And by constantly outsourcing your friction to those external tools, what inherent internal human ability within yourself are you allowing to quietly fade away?
An uncomfortable, essential question to ask yourself the next time you reflexively reach for your phone to solve a problem. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We appreciate your curiosity and your willingness to explore the absolute limits of human potential with us. Until next time, keep challenging your mental models, and we will see you on the next deep dive.